Welcome, folks, to Film Strips, the podcast in which I try and come up with a tagline every episode, and yet this time I failed miserably to come up with something that was funny or clever. I'm Dave Babbitt.
And I'm Andrew Kanegeiser.
Yes. So welcome back, folks, to our latest episode. So once again, in case we have any new listeners joining in, this is the podcast in which, you know, each episode, subsequent episode has to connect back in some way, shape, or form to the one that preceded
it. I think you're on to something, Dave. I think we need to come up with, like, a snazzier way of putting it. Because your old one, 24 Panels, the podcast about comic books on film. Whereas here, it's 6 degrees of separation with your ears, and also you can't look at it, but we're talking about films that you have to look at to understand with Dave.
And it never ends.
Yes. Yeah. Just like our tagline. We'll come up with something. Stay tuned.
Yes. So in essence, that's the general gist of the show. So last time, we were taking a look at what little film, Andrew?
What were we looking at last time?
That would be...
Wow.
Jim Jarmusch's Dead Man.
Oh, yes. Wait, how did it connect? Oh, yeah, you'll have to explain this one to me. Oh, wait, no, now I remember. Wow. For anyone who says that higher education is a great thing, try trying to remember dates, times, and what you did last week after 8 continuous hours in lecture. Last week we looked at Jim Jarmusch's acid western from 1995, Dead Man. And this week, well, Dave's got the wheel and I'm in the passenger seat. So let's open up that glove box and where have we arrived?
We have ended up following Robert Mitchum all the way to 1975 for Farewell, My Lovely, Dick Richards' adaptation of the Raymond Chandler novel, which itself had been previously adapted several times before, basically as sort of films without the character of Philip Marlowe, and then properly with Philip Marlowe, its protagonist, as the film Murder, My Sweet, starring Dick Powell, which, again, not to keep reminding you to go back and listen to a podcast that you probably can't download right now. Was an old Cinema Chase episode that me and James covered way, way, way back in the early days of that long lost
friend of the show, James Rivnak.
Yes. And both of us love that film. I'm pretty sure we can find a way to get people to be able to listen to that one again, one way, shape, or form. But needless to say, very good movie. And like I said, I mean, I think most people are familiar, at least in name, with the character of Philip Marlowe and his creator, Raymond Chandler.
I think if you have any awareness of noir in literature or in film, you know who Philip Marlowe is. He's the quintessential gumshoe, the hard luck private eye, the knight with tarnished armor. The man who's eternally down on his luck, but somehow never finds the resolve to give up on the world.
And if you haven't actually paid attention to classic noirs or watched any of them, you probably at least know the films that are indebted to it, such as The Big Lebowski, which, while a comedy, is ostensibly more a remake of The Big Sleep, at least as far as its plot's concerned, and its convoluted nature. But that's sort of digressing down a road we don't need to head into so far.
Not this week, anyway.
Yeah, it's very true. But to sort of get things started here, Andrew, you called this, a noir. And why don't you just remind our listeners, for those who maybe aren't familiar with the term, what do we mean when we say film noir?
Okay, film noir. It's one of those quintessentially American genres, much like the Western was last time we were recording. The noir basically, it's the seedy side of American life in terms of its content. We're talking about the femme fatale, the down on his luck private dick. We're talking smoky bars and jazz halls. And aesthetically, it makes use of high contrast black and white. But, I mean, by that same definition, every American film made prior to colorization would be a noir film. Noir, it uses its formal aesthetics and its composition to really bring out that narrative point of the seediness or the unseen aspects of what's ostensibly polite society. In America, it sees a huge proliferation around 1940, because that's when, well, no nice way to say this, that's when under Hitler, a lot of German filmmakers end up fleeing the country and coming to America, and they bring a visual style that's heavily, heavily indebted to German expressionism, which, like American noir later would, it uses cinematography, set design, composition to reflect the interior subjectivity of the characters on screen. So the setting, the city, even the framing of certain shots become as much a part of, they're as much a part of the cast as the characters are.
Well, and this kind of brings us to a key point. You refer to it as a genre, but this is actually one of those points that becomes highly debated amongst film scholars and, you know, if those who aren't film scholars, at least massive film nerds. Certainly, there's been debate. Some people prefer to call it a mode or a, you know, aesthetic as opposed to a particular...
Yeah, it's like a variation on the detective film. You have your police procedurals. You have sort of inversely the heist film, the classic mystery or sleuth film, and then there's noir.
Yeah, and not in the one of the things that's sort of a big distinction here is that it, noir doesn't inherently necessarily mean a detective story per se, because plenty of them are not necessarily wouldn't classify as detective tales at all. Double Indemnity, one of the most famous examples, is basically a tale of lust and corruption and murder, but not really a mystery or detective story as we would traditionally think of it. Or something like Detour, which if you haven't had the chance to see Detour, find Detour, watch Detour, and then get back to us, because trust me, you're in for a treat watching that one. And in a nice brisk 60 or so minutes. But I digress. Point is yeah, it's one of those terms where we're going to probably refer to it mostly as a genre throughout this podcast, for, I would say, probably, if nothing else, simplicity's sake, and being consistent, because I don't think we're going to summarize, you know, 30 years of academia as it relates to this.
Well, yeah. Maybe a useful distinction is there are sort of hard genres where the Western, for instance, where it's not just an aesthetic, but it's also a very specific kind of narrative being told, very familiar icons being put forth to tell it. Noir is more of a soft genre where it's much more about tone, mood, and aesthetics than necessarily, you know, recurring narrative tropes. Can we agree on that?
I think that it's good for our purposes, yes. So we'll go with that for now. But, like, again, go out. Find yourself some nice film texts. You'll learn much.
But now I have a question for you, David. Yes. If the era of noir is the 1940s, well, the movie we're looking at today is from 1975. What gives?
Yes. So basically, noir is generally sort of held to conclude around 1958, 1959, particularly with the release of Orson Welles' Touch of Evil. Now, from that point forward, we sort of move into what's now basically become known as neo-noir. Although I would probably note at this point that given that neo-noir seems to be lasting significantly longer as a period of time than noir itself originally was, we may want to try and find at some point academics, you know, more divisions here, because it seems really unfair to refer to everything after 1958 as neo-noir. But as, again, digression. To put it blunt simply, basically, after 1958, we sort of get into a series of films which are evocative of noir, and I think, if to put it in very reductive terms, they are evocative of, overtly, of what was filmmakers in the 40s and 50s who weren't operating on the basis that they were doing anything of what noir is. Because, again, we should note that film noir as a term was, you know, applied after their creation, and not by a group of French critics, and not by something that they said, well, this is what we're making. So by the time we sort of get into this, there's a more self-conscious, you know, sense with neo-noir as to what they're trying
to do. Well, yeah, there's also a certain core of films have emerged and developed that are stylistically similar that, you know, then contemporary filmmakers could then look back on and make deliberate and overt references to. John Huston didn't have that luxury while making The Maltese Falcon, for instance. That's the pain of being a pioneer, I suppose.
Very true. And the thing that's sort of key here is that, I mean, part of the thing is that it ends up becoming a rather diverse array, because even though when they're sort of evoking these conventions and concepts of film noir, you know, they get spun in some incredibly radically different ways. So probably most famously, I would say for our purposes, you get something like Ridley Scott's Blade Runner, which is not a traditional noir by any stretch of the imagination, and yet so much of it structurally and visually is clearly evocative of those films, even though this is a big science fiction film.
And I think that really illustrates your earlier point, because Blade Runner is, you know, I think in strict terms, it's science fiction, it's speculative fiction, but its treatment is very much through the lens of noir. And I think that that's a good point to illustrate what you mentioned earlier.
Yeah, and I mean, we see this sort of variation in different things. I mean, we've seen things such as To Live and Die in L.A. referred to as a neo-noir. Then you get things such as L.A. Confidential, which is definitely, you know, constitutes a neo-noir. And yet, that one is probably about as far from Blade Runner in other regards as well, because that one is strictly a sort of historical piece in terms of both being a period film, and it's also trying to deliberately recreate an era that noir was actually covering contemporaneously, in a way. And that's probably our most famous example. But that brings us back to the film in question here, I would say. Am I safe in saying that, Andrew?
I think you're safe.
Yeah, so basically, yeah, when we're talking about Farewell, My Lovely, this is kind of a, again, a peculiar film. Because, as we know, this was previously filmed as Murder, My Sweet. It's a Raymond Chandler mystery following his Private Eye Philip Marlowe, who is pretty much on the case after being sort of shanghaied into trying to help find this missing woman for a con who's gotten out of prison after 7 years, basically starts finding himself in over his head and also taking up a secondary case in which he's supposed to be more or less the bag man for a payoff to get a piece of jewelry back, which ends in murder.
Yes, as it often does. And in investigating the second murder, it becomes clear that maybe there's a connection between the two cases after all. And old sad Zach Marlowe finds himself square in the middle of it.
Yes. Now, the thing about it is that's a pretty straightforward premise. And as it's told in the Dick Powell film, starring film, you know, that's pretty much what you get. It's a sort of straightforward rendition of that murder mystery, and a damn fine, good one, I might add. Again, seriously, highly recommend that one if you want to see what is pretty much a prototypical sort of classic noir, as it were. But that begs the question then, because basically, Farewell, My Lovely, in terms of its plot, as we're sort of describing it, is really would seem like just a retread, Andrew. And I would you say that that's pretty safe to say?
I would say, yeah, in the sense that, I mean, Raymond Chandler's novels themselves, I mean, you don't have to reinvent the wheel. I mean, they're labyrinthine, and there are all sorts of loose ends that even Chandler didn't realize were in there. But there's so much in the text to pull from, it's almost ready-made for the cinema. So I guess the question is, why redo Farewell, My Lovely, and what does this film do that the previous version did not?
Yes, and it's kind of interesting to put this in context, because this film comes out in sort of in the midst of, I guess we could call it sort of a Chandler-Marlowe renaissance, as it were, in the 1970s. Because in addition to this film, prior to it, we had the James Gardner starring film Marlowe in the late 1960s. Unless I'm mistaken, The Long Goodbye was a couple years before, which was a sort of contemporary take with Elliot Gould as Philip Marlowe based on the novel The Long Goodbye.
Very Gould indeed.
Yes, and then you have this film. And I would say what really strikes this one is particularly different from those two films immediately before it and the one that would follow after it, the not quite a sequel to this film, The Big Sleep, which also happens to star Robert Mitchum in the Marlowe role as he does in this film, and otherwise has zero connection, is basically that this is a period piece. This is one that very squarely puts Marlowe back into the 1940s, as it were, which doesn't necessarily seem like a big deal on the surface of it, and yet this is a film coming out in the midst of what we would call sort of New Hollywood, this sort of post-studio era, in which case we're sort of, you know, comes with a different content restrictions, comes with a very different sensibility in many yeah. regards as to how it approaches its subject matter.
No more Hays Code. And,
yeah, definitely no more Hays Code. And then you have this film, which again, quite differently from, say, the Raymond Chandler novel, which was being written in the midst of the era in which it's a story set in the era in which it was written. This is a film that is deliberately now basically taking that story in more in a far more fixed manner, positioning it as a historical story.
Yeah, because this film, I guess by the timeline, it would take place in 1941, right before America enters World War II? Or yes. Is it 42? I can't remember the year of DiMaggio's hitting streak.
I think it's 41.
But yeah, there's a sort of... I think you're right to identify that, Dave, because by suddenly making it a period piece as opposed to a contemporaneous one, you're adding that level of, like, detachment. And I think that's important in two ways, because it's looking back on contemporaneous issues to noir's heyday and sort of having a more critical look at it, reflecting on what that decade meant, what was really going on, and being able to depict it in ways that you couldn't in the 1940s. But I think also emerging out of New Hollywood, and I think we introduced that back in the One from the Heart episode. Short version, Hollywood's out of money. European art cinema is taking off. All these young Americans suddenly can get the studios to agree to give them $2 million to squeak out a film, and everyone's fine with it. So this film itself ends up being Americans making a film based on classic Americana filtered through a very European art house influence.
Yeah, and the end result is a film which, from a narrative standpoint, is pretty much the same film you've seen, and yet it takes on very new meanings and new depth in a way that, again, not, this is not a slam on either Chandler or on the previous adaptation, they simply couldn't do, at least in the way that this film is approaching it, because they were in the midst of what this film is talking about with that distance, as you're referring to, whether it's, you know, historical perspective. And we should know, you know, this is a film, you know, made by director Dick Richards, who, according to, if the wonders of the internet are to be believed, was born in 1936, New York City. So, you know, this is somebody who, right as the, you know, Chandler novels being published and the original film adaptation happened, he's still a kid. So it's not like this is an older filmmaker looking back on an era that they are a part of history that they were part of, in the same sense of, say, if John Huston had made this film, or...
Yeah, it's not a nostalgia for society or the way things were then, as much as a nostalgia for a certain kind of film style.
Yes, exactly. And in that sense, I mean, it's a fascinating movie, in a beautiful movie, in a way that... if you're predisposed to like that and find that sort of stuff interesting, boy, is this the movie for you. So I guess the big question is, because we've sort of established this sort of grandiose framework for this film, Andrew, I would say, and it would be easy to speak in generalities about it. So where do we want to start sort of picking through this film and sort of start getting into the nitty-gritty details of it?
I think maybe the through line of this film as sort of a look back on itself and its own history, I think maybe the best point to start is Robert Mitchum and how he plays Marlowe, especially compared to the other famous ones on screen. Probably the most notable would be Humphrey Bogart in The Big Sleep.
Yes.
I think that's the go-to iconic one. And Mitchum plays the same character. I mean, they're both pretty close to the book itself. But Mitchum adds his own sort of flavor to the character that's pretty lovable. I mean, in 1975, Mitchum is no longer a young man, and the narrative itself is about Marlowe growing older and sort of resigning himself to his fate. And there's this weird, almost like perfect resonance between the character doing this and Robert Mitchum as the aging film star in that part.
Yeah, and I mean, it's certainly notable that, from what I can tell, one of the criticisms, you know, held against the film, when at least it was in production, was the idea of Mitchum being too old for the role.
Well, he was still making movies 20 years later.
Well, exactly, but I mean, certainly traditionally up to this point, I mean, I would say probably Bogey was the oldest actor to have taken on the role. Even then, I think he was still in his 40s at most when he did it.
Young enough for Lauren Bacall to find him handsome.
Exactly. And I mean, in the prior adaptation, you had Dick Richards, who was significantly younger than Mitchum, is in the big, or in the Farewell, My Lovely. And then, I mean, again, to look at the Marlowes who had come immediately before Mitchum, you have James Gardner, who was in his heyday as a star, and Elliot Gould, who really doesn't fit any sort of additional mold that we would think of Marlowe per se.
So if Bogart is X-Men 2, then Mitchum is Logan.
That's a fair enough assessment.
It's sort of end of cycle for the character, in a way. And I guess that sort of embrace of his own finitude and sort of him wondering about, like, what his role is in the world and in society, I mean, that in itself works on a meta level as well, where it's sort of that overt interrogation of, well, what is the value of noir as a form? What is the value of even making period pieces? But the way that Mitchum plays it, like, I mean, Marlowe as a character is hard-nosed, always has a snappy comeback, has a very cynical sense of humor, but that humor is reserved for, like, one-liners and that in Bogart's version, you know, deployed sporadically, whereas Mitchum, like, he approaches everything not as a laugh, but that he has a crack about everything because he really comes off as a guy who's just so world-weary that he has nothing left to lose. And even taking cases, it's like, well, it's probably not going to go so well, but what else do I have to lose? You can't make my life any worse. Like, especially when he's being sweated down by the detectives, or there's a number of junctures where he calls the police to a scene, and he's sitting there next to a dead body, and he just waves to the cops. He's like, yep, he's over here, fellas. There's a sense of carefreeness about it that's also a grim resignation at the same time.
Yeah, and I think it does speak, again, to sort of, you know, make the comparison to the Dick Powell version. I mean, a good way to look at it is both films have frame narratives, because the films are, for the most part, looking back on events that had preceding it. And now, in the case of the Dick Powell version, it opens up with him being sweated down by the cops, his eyes bandaged up because he's been temporarily blinded, and he's having to recall the events of things. So we sort of see Marlowe at a low point at the start of that film. We technically do here as well, but it's a very different sense of low point, because A, Marlowe is sort of in hiding, and it basically is, well, I guess I better get on with things. I'm going to call the cops and, you know, try and talk to the one not crooked detective and just sort of try and explain how the things got this bad this quickly over it. So, you know, there's a bit more. It's not even so much an issue of agency as it is resignation that, well, I better get this over with, because if I don't now, maybe I won't get to later. That's caked into the way in which this film's framed. And, I mean, our first image of Marlowe in this film is him in a really shoddy hotel room, or motel room, with a, what is it, bourbon in his hand? Whiskey?
Yeah, I think it's whiskey, overflowing ashtray, the staples.
Yeah.
Looking Bob Mitchum's miracle diet.
Looking out, yeah, over LA's, you know, more neon lit areas, and it's just, there is such a wonderful grime,
yeah,
in this film that is, and again, sort of coming back to sort of the visual difference. I mean, one of the big obvious differences is that this is a film that's shot in color compared to the other ones. But I don't know whether this is a byproduct of shooting in color. I'm going to assume no, because I mean, obviously we've seen other color films from the same period that look gorgeous. but there seems to be a real aesthetic choice to de-glamorize.
Yeah, it's sort of, if I may coin a term, tech noir color, where we suddenly have a very expressive use of color, but here it's deployed to the effect of making everything look as scummy and rundown as possible. What is it? What's the character's name? Florian's wife, Jessie. That's the one.
Oh, yes.
Like,
yes,
her house in particular, with the fading stucco on the sides and, like, the dead lawn in front of it. Like, yeah. Even 20 years prior, we have Singing in the Rain, which is one of the most, like, visually pleasing films ever made, using Technicolor. Here, it's the same process, but to the exact opposite effect.
Yeah, it's really striking because, again, I think, again, in terms of scholarship, the way in which noirs are traditionally discussed, it's like, well, there was a lot of location shooting. It was, you know, visually darker and more real. And that's true to an extent. But classic noir was still, they're Hollywood productions. They are, you know, if not necessarily big budget, at least, you know, pricey pictures made by professionals and designed in terms of the sort of classic Hollywood aesthetic to be still kind of slick and glamorous, as it were, even when you're dealing with shady characters, as it were. You know, they're being played by the biggest and best movie stars. The sets are going to look, you know, like, you know, it's designer, you know, rundown. Whereas this film is, no, this it looks like, you know, the unfortunate hellhole you happen to maybe be living by. I think I'm giving people a really dark image of what my life is right now, which it couldn't be further from the truth of what it is. But yeah, I mean, there is definitely that sense that this is, you know, a response in some way to the way in which Hollywood would, you know, sort of glamorize these, you know, darker, cynical worlds by saying, no, this is not really a fun place to be in. This is not, you know, a joyous thing. Yeah. Like, I mean,
they're not gentlemen rogues in this film. They're just criminals.
Well, and it's even the thing, like, I mean, our sort of world-weary detective, we say that, but I think we, you know, again, as a sort of a larger cultural image, we tend to have a very romanticized look at, feeling as to what that is. I mean, who hasn't necessarily imagined, you know, being like, again, to come back to Bogart, being Bogey in a film. There is something, you know, even in his cynicism and world weariness, there's something attractive and something appealing to being that character. I'm not necessarily sure anybody would want to be Bob Mitchum in Farewell, My Lovely, not least because of the amount of beatings he takes in this thing. But, I mean, yeah, as you've acknowledged, this guy looks worn down from start to finish. And, you know, Bob Mitchum's a handsome guy. But this is also a 57, I think Amanda was about, what, 57 at this point, and he looks every year of that.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, maybe if we unspool the narratives a bit, because in some ways it's a straightforward film, but there's also a lot of moving parts, and I think that's part of the joy of watching anyone play Marlowe, because he gets involved with cases that are so confusing that he's kind of just forced to go along with things and hope that it's going to make sense. And structurally, that's exactly what happens in this film. But the impetus is he's looking for a teen runaway, and then he's approached by Moose Malloy, played by Jack Halloran, who who did he play in Superman, David?
Nod.
The man. Yes. And who is basically the, I wouldn't say a gentle giant, but a lovesick lumbering lug, who hires him to track down Velma, his former flame from before he got sent up the river for 7 years for bank robbery. And that's in the back pocket at all times, because Moose then very quickly just disappears, and he pops up every now and then. But the emphasis is then shunted onto, well, in one of those purposeful evocations, and what's the character's name there? Marriott. Played by John O'Leary, who's a rather dandified man who shows up in Marlowe's office and asks him to come along as the backup man for a handoff, trading money for a necklace that was stolen. And that scene, I think, really, really underscores what you were talking about of sort of that looking back on itself. Where, I mean, I laughed out loud because he greets Marriott at the door, lets him into the office, and it's also important that Mitchum has an omnipresent voiceover narration through the film, and it's used to great effect at some points. Because he lets Marion into the office, and then you just hear, apropos of nothing, Bob Mitchum go, "He smelled very nice." And I laughed out loud. But it's so weird, though, because the Joel Cairo scene in The Maltese Falcon, Bogart sniffs Peter Lorre's business card and mentions, Gardein, a woman's perfume. Because in classic noir, you have to code certain things a certain way. And in the case of Marriott, like, this film has the freedom to say, hey, everyone, Marriott is a homosexual. And other characters state that more or less deliberately. But in that moment, there's, even though they don't have to, they're still playing with the same sort of linguistic games to get around code strictures.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's interesting which the way the film plays around with that, because there are points where this movie does get quite explicit in terms of its content. I mean, it, you know, this is an R-rated film, and while it doesn't wallow in the sleazier aspects of it, they're there. And certainly in a far more forefronted in a way that you did not see in, say, the Dick Powell film. Certainly, and in most of the sort of classic versions of noir. But yeah, no, I mean, you're absolutely right. And it's very curious how it sort of picks and chooses that, because it's interesting that so many of these things, as you know, they were coded in classic Hollywood or marginalized and pushed completely off screen altogether. So, for example, one of the big points we didn't note in the early goings of this film is when Marlowe is sort of initially brought by Moose Malloy, one of the first places they go is to a club. And this is a club where, you know, Moose's Velma, the woman that he is seeking after 7 years, used to work. And if I remember correctly, in the Dick Powell version, it's just a club. In both the original novel and in this version here, it is a club specifically for black residents.
Yeah,
or for
it's
black
a segregated club.
Yes, and that's something, yeah, the Dick Powell version doesn't touch on. And again, reading Raymond Chandler's novel, Chandler was a man of his time.
Yep, so was H.P. Lovecraft.
Which is not giving them a pass, just simply acknowledging it's not surprising that that's the way he necessarily treated. But here, that is, I mean, it's not only acknowledged, it's a way to sort of, and again, I almost want to call this a bit maybe revisionist noir in a way, because it's reinserting something that was very deliberately removed from the original version. But then it not only does that, but it also makes this kind of a, not necessarily a plot point, but it becomes something that's foregrounded as important for Marlowe throughout the rest of the film, because this leads to him encountering an interracial couple that lives across the street from this club as part of his investigation, and sort of how he relates to their child and how they are sort of, you know, people choose to talk about this couple becomes, again, not plot relevant per se, but the notion of how race plays into how the LAPD functions in the 1940s.
Well, yeah, can you imagine a 1940s film showing an interracial couple, for instance?
Yeah.
And yeah, I think you're right that some things are pushed out to the edge whenever convenient, but I think by having that as a plot point, though, I mean, it also makes more sense, because when we meet Malloy, like, before we get carried away with thinking, oh, he's just a big, lovable guy who can rip you in half, like, one of the first things he does is he kills a man in self-defense. And, you know, we're kind of left with that. But when Marlowe's at the scene and the cops show up, Malloy's gone, but the cops are also completely uninterested in investigating it, because to them, they just see it as black-on-black crime. So that buys Marlowe a little bit of a head start in a way.
Yeah, and I mean, it's one of those things where, yeah, I mean, again, it's interesting how Mitchum plays it, because it's not like the interpretation they give of Marlowe is this, he's an over-crusading moralist, necessarily, or somebody who's, you know, crusading for, you know, the end of racial segregation and, you know, basically promoting, you know, racial equality. But the point of the matter is he is presented as somebody who he recognizes why people do it. And he's, you know, he will call them out on that. Because I think what's the line he gets when the police show up? It's like, oh, 30 minutes for a murder.
Yeah. Not bad for this part of town. But Marlowe is deep down a pragmatist, right? Like, the whole reason that he plays everything close and doesn't reveal anything with the cops, even though McNulty, is it? Nick Nulty. That's another one. John Ireland. Yeah. Lieutenant Nulty is very much the one good cop left on the force. And him and Marlowe have that interesting camaraderie because they're both sort of, they're both realists in a sense. Only one's working within the system and the other's on the outside. But Marlowe, he actually states, he's like, well, regardless of what you think about Malloy, he's my client and he's paying me, so I'm not going to give any info about him. And when you think about it, he needs to, because otherwise how's he going to pay his phone bill, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, there are these moments of, like, sort of tolerance and understanding and a certain degree of grace that, like all the scenes with Mrs. Florian as well, where Marlowe comes off as very sympathetic and understanding, but it's also underwritten by a profit motive and the fact that, well, he has to get his job done as well.
Yeah, it very much is. And it's interesting, again, sort of reading it against the original novel itself, scenes like that where they choose to emphasize things such as Ms. Florian. They make it very explicit that she is a racist bigot in the film, which is not something that, as near as I can remember, actually happens in the text of the novel itself. And likewise, that initial confrontation in the novel ends on a much more violent note with Marlowe than what we end up seeing in the film version, where he's more laid back as Mitchum plays him here and less likely to get extremely, you know, aggressive.
He just basically sits there and watches her get drunk, and the most he ever gives is like a raised eyebrow and a, oh yeah, tell me more.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's a very, it's very, very interesting. And again, there's something about the fact that even though it's something technically from the original text, the way in which you have Robert Mitchum sort of encountering this woman who there is sort of cues about the way in which she's presented, which almost suggests like fading old Hollywood glamour.
She's also a former cabaret girl as well.
Very true. Yes. Where you can sort of read into the meta commentary as to, you know, this is almost a, you know, an ode to a passing era, if not an uncritical one, as it were.
And I guess it's weird because second build is Charlotte Rampling, who plays Helen Grail, who is basically the mysterious woman of the film. But it's odd that she's cast so prominently, considering she's not really in the film all that much. But Marlowe ends up encountering her because the necklace that was stolen actually apparently belonged to her. And she is a woman that's married to one of the power brokers in L.A., and he gets caught up in that inner circle. And in the span of about 3 minutes of meeting Helen, they end up making out on the futon.
Yeah, it's sort of, it's very interesting. And again, I love the way which they play the judge in this scene as a sort of, you know, feeble, impotent individual who just is, you know, utterly powerless to do anything about this in that scene. They get some really great comedic material. On top of which, did you note who played the judge by any chance?
I did not.
He's played by Jim Thompson, who you may not necessarily know much as an actor, but boy God, you know him as a writer, having written stuff such as the novel The Getaway, The Killer Inside Me, the writer on The Killing. Again, just sort of I don't know how he ended up in this movie, but it's a fascinating casting choice that, again, sort of throws, you know, again, more of that sort of weird meta-text going on in the fact that it is evocative of not just, you know, old Hollywood, but sort of, you know, classic crime writers, as it were. But, again, sort of digression, not sure I had much of a point to go off of that one.
I think it speaks to the fact that, like, this is a film made out of an appreciation for the style. But and of course, like, there are the, I wouldn't say it's necessarily, it feels weird to call, like, presenting non-white individuals on screen as an innovation.
Yeah.
But the idea of, like, pushing it in directions that the classic period couldn't go, while at the same time maintaining that love for where it comes from. I guess probably the only... Okay, so I'm just trying to, like, okay. You and I, we talked about it before, we both agree that this film is very difficult not to love.
Yeah.
And I think it speaks to that classic Hollywood style of, like, okay, well, maybe it's not reinventing things, but you open up a watch and you see all the parts moving together. There's something satisfying about it. That being said, I think the one moment where it sort of loses its noirness is, and you can probably guess, when Marlo is kidnapped by a bunch of goons working on behalf of, what's her name?
Yeah, the Hollywood madam.
The madam. It's Frances Amthor, played by Kate Murtaugh, who's this burly matriarch running a cat house and blackmailing all the power brokers in L.A. And one of her goons, a young Sylvester Stallone, post-Bananas but pre-Rocky.
But not just Stallone, but Joe Spinell as well, which, I mean, talk about two guys from a very different, you know, era of Hollywood from Bob Mitchum. Just such a different cats in this film. And much, I think it's very notable how Dick Richards plays them as even scummier, I think, than anything else in this movie. But sorry, I didn't mean to sidetrack.
Well, that's all right, because it turns out that everybody is trying to solve the same bigger mystery, but no one knows what that mystery is. Everybody knows that it hinges on Moose Malloy, but nobody can find him, so they all keep going after Marlowe, because he's the only point of connection that might be able to explain what everything's all about. And so he gets sweated down by Amthor, and then he gets shot full of dope, and that leads to just a... It's a very bizarre scene of him basically going through psychosis, locked in a room full of spinning camera shots, superimposed faces of women laughing, and, like, it's the kind of sequence that would not... This is the only sequence that feels out of its period, I guess.
I guess I should say this, because I keep talking to you with the assumption that you've seen Murder, My Sweet. Have you seen that?
I have not seen Murder, My Sweet.
Because it is a plot detail that is featured in that film as well. And if one of the key things about the way in which they handle it there is there's the superimposition of, like, almost spider cobwebs, you know, as a filter overlaid of over the screen as Marlowe's going through, you know, being doped up and knocked out and trying to sort of get his way out of that state there. So, I mean, on one hand, I would say you're right that this film is more extreme in the way in which it sort of dramatizes Marlowe's descent into, you know, drug-addled madness temporarily, I guess, as it were. And yet it kind of feels, in a way, it still feels right because, again, we don't necessarily associate that sort of drugged out trippiness with the 1940s. And yet, you know, that almost leads us, again, this coming back to this notion of reinserting missing history. You know, drug abuse in the 1940s very much existed. It wasn't the invention of the 1960s or 1970s. So I think there is something about the way in which, you're right, it's not classically noir, but it's adding a visceral edge that, again, makes sense contemporaneously for the 1970s in terms of the harshness of it.
Well, yeah. Plus, then... So I guess the other piece is, and I know this is owing also to Chandler's novel, but I think the way that the interrogation by Amthor is composed is also very interesting. Because you have Robert Mitchum, who, you know, in his day was one of the men's men in Hollywood. And, you know, a very chiseled face. He's tied to a chair while Sylvester Stallone is staring at him. But even he gets relegated to the back seat while Amthor interrogates him. And the way she is framed from below, like she's this towering and monstrous figure. She's very restrained, but there's like such a sense of menace about her that, you know, like for all we talk about the archetype of the femme fatale, I mean, that's more of a character like Helen. Whereas I think doesn't Marlowe overtly call Amthor the Dragon Lady at one point?
I believe he does, and there's some definite implications as to her relationship with some of her subordinates, at least one in particular that becomes important later on.
And the relationship
That's
is that she's a lesbian.
yeah, that yeah, certainly is not something we would have seen in the ni 1940s film. Not to mention, I don't think that that character was in the original novel either. I think that was something that was innovated for this particular incarnation of it. Ostensibly, I think based probably on some sort of real seedy Hollywood story. I wouldn't be surprised. But yeah, no, I mean, you're right in that there is something very threatening about her, and it's very interesting because there's then a supposed reversal, maybe like what, 5, 6 minutes later, when Marlowe, getting out of his drunken haze, confronts her with a gun. And it's a scene which ostensibly should suddenly give Marlowe back some sort of sense of agency and control of the situation. And the way in which it's staged and played by everyone, totally deflates the notion that Marlowe has any say in how this entire situation's
Well,
going.
yeah, because she points out, it's like, you're shot full of hop and you've been bedridden for a couple days, and now you're pointing a gun and you can barely stand up. You're not going to shoot me. And he's like, okay, can you pour me a drink then? So then they just have a cocktail and talk about what they know about this case.
It's absolutely, it's like, and then lo and behold, this completely separate, weird sub-story of a different movie that's happening in the background where Sly Stallone is one of the leads suddenly interrupts and completely disrupts this film and gets us back on track with Mitchum going off and continuing his
Yeah,
investigation
that's what
elsewhere.
we joked about on Twitter. Yeah, the film contains a scene where Robert Mitchum is shot full of dope and stumbles out of a cat house at midnight holding a gun. And as you pointed out, yeah, I think that's how he showed up to set.
And I guess again that sort of brings us back again to sort of possibly the metatextual elements of this, because again, Bob Mitchum was also one of the first Hollywood stars, if I'm not mistaken, to have been associated with certain illegal substances and arrested for that.
Yep, and he had quite the reputation for himself. But yeah, it's like that's the thing. It's I've okay. Some of the films we've looked at are very subtextual, I think, in that Dead Man certainly like it promotes the viewer to read it in deeper terms. Whereas I feel like there's not so much of that impulse here. Like it's not a film that's purely being made for escapism or aesthetics. But I think much more than some of the other films we've looked at, it's a lot more like narrative oriented.
Yeah, no, this is certainly a film where the focus is still very much on there's a case, that case needs to be solved, there's going to be a resolution of some sort. It's that ultimately I find the detail, so much the case itself becomes ultimately irrelevant, because I think anybody, again, if you'd seen the prior versions or read the book, you know where it's going to ultimately end up leading towards. If you're, and I think anybody who's seen a film noir or at least a detective story prior to this can probably put the pieces together of the mystery ultimately pretty quickly together. Not necessarily the way in which they exactly fit, but who's involved and for what purposes that they are. But the details of the world that's Dick Richards is sort of building up around the story, I think, are kind of fascinating, because there is this sort of emphasis on, again, we've sort of been mentioning these sort of things that this film is reinserting historically that were, sort of pushed aside in prior incarnations or have been whitewashed out of the history. But here we have in instances also the fact that this pegs it squarely in the context of war is about to break out. Because you see throughout this, I mean, there's a exchange early on when Marlowe's picking up a paper from his extremely close newspaper salesman
What?
throughout this
You
film.
don't occasionally crash at your newsstand vendor's apartment?
No, I can't say that I have offhand. But yeah, I mean, you have this individual and there's things like, hey, you know, he gets that line, it's like, Hitler invaded Russia. And you have this sort of exchange, and it's not plot relevant in any way, shape, or form, but it's part of this sort of larger tapestry, I guess, for lack of better term at the moment, of what's going on in this film, where, yeah, this is a story that's really, when you consider the grand scheme of what's going on in the world at this time, doesn't really amount to much there, and it's kind of hard not to see that as a point, particularly when, even when everything's sort of wrapped up, one of the last shots we see is of Marlowe in this arcade failing to play this sort of, what is it, pinball, baseball arcade game.
Because the other narrative through line that's historical is that this occurs during Joe DiMaggio's 56-game hitting streak.
Yeah.
And that kind of ends up being the, whenever that comes up, it's sort of, that seems to be where the narrative reorients itself. It kind of reframes itself against that. And, like, Marlowe is definitely cheering for Jolting Joe, but it's also one of those things where he's reflecting on, well, could he break the record? That would be crazy. That would be next to impossible. But, hey, it could happen. And so there ends up being, like, these twin narratives of improbable feats made by, you know, just ordinary people. And all of it's against the backdrop of World War II, so you're right. I mean, Moose Malloy's broken heart doesn't really amount to anything in a universal sense, but it's what Marlowe's doing because it's what he's signed on for.
No, you're absolutely right. I think it's also interesting to come back to the baseball thing. The motif of who holds the ball throughout this film becomes sort of this interesting thing, and what that sort of means at any given point. It seems, it's one of those things where I'm sort of thinking about how you would frame it, because in one hand, it seems like this is the case where you could almost read this, you know, overtly symbolically in the sense of, well, it's who's in control of the situation at any given moment. But then you have key details like, again, the child of the trumpeter and his wife, who Marlowe sort of passes the ball back and forth a couple points. And again, sort of becomes a significant point for Marlowe, particularly as we reach the closing moments of this film. I mean, what does that ultimately mean? I mean, again, it seems to be the sense of this is something that's maybe unifying these sort of divergent cultures or things that are being, again, literally segregated, as it were, across each other and is sort of binding people together in some way, which, again, I don't know whether that ultimately amounts to a hill of beans in terms of this film thematically in any way, shape, or form.
Well, also, at the same time, Marriott, when he's in the office, he keeps playing with the baseball as well. And, I mean, that could also be, like, sort of a crude textual joke in itself. But I think it's significant that when he gets up to leave, he's about to walk up and he's still holding the baseball. And Marlowe notices and he tosses it back to him. And Marriott as a character, like, he tries to dupe Marlowe, right? The whole idea of, like, the handoff, I mean, Marriott's being duped, and he thinks he's also putting one over on Marlowe at the same time, but Marlowe, being that one step ahead, even if he doesn't know what the actual mystery is, he's able to get the ball back. So I think there's some legs to that reading.
Yeah, possibly, yeah. I just, again, it might just be a small detail, not something worth necessarily making a major, you know, sort of argument or reading into too much, but it is very significant how that sort of factors in over the course of the film. And we haven't even, again, I think also I sort of sidetracked this way, way back about Charlotte Rampling, when we started talking about her in this film, the fact that she doesn't have a major role per se in the film, and yet ostensibly, she's the crux of this whole movie sort of revolves around ultimately.
Well, yes, because it turns out that Helen and the missing Velma, Moose's lost love, in the literally like the last 4 minutes of the film, we discover that, yes, they are one and the same person. That she was behind it all. She was trying to set up Moose to get the money from the bank robbery, and then they were basically going to kill him and cover their tracks.
Well, partly that, and also to help keep the cover her sordid history, because as we sort of come to discover, she did work as a prostitute and is now married to one of the most powerful, you know, individuals in LA at this point in time, something which, should that get out, would probably put a bit of a damper on both his career and their position in society.
Yeah. So in that meta sense, again, it's like Helen as a character is basically active. She's committing an act of sort of self-sanitization, right? She's burying the seedier elements, but they're eventually destined to come to the fore.
Yeah. And come to the fore with Anthony Zerbe.
Oh, yes. We'd be remiss if we didn't talk about him.
Yeah, who's just sort of... Again, basically, he's more or less just sort of like a wealthy thug, I guess is the best way. Sort of connected man about town.
He's an operator.
Yeah. And it's just, yeah, I mean... You know, when he pops up in a film, you're not casting him to play the noble individual. The dude was always cast as sleazebags throughout his career. I'm proud to say that this film continues that tradition for him. So, good on you, Dick Richards?
Well, yeah. He ends up, I don't know if they added extra shine to his face or something, but he does look like a sufficiently greasy man. and yeah, he kind of... He has sort of like the Peter Lorre role, where he is a marginal character in the film, but he makes the most out of all of his scenes, because when he first meets Marlowe, he makes him the job offer. He says, come work for me, investigate this mystery, and I'll pay you. And, you know, he looks well-to-do, high society, the smooth talker. But then, in the climactic scene, he is basically left cowering in his office, and all of that power is taken away. And then it's further revealed that, no, the actual brains behind the operation was Helen. So that's another moment in the film where there's that interest. It's not that this film is interrogative of masculinity or tropes of masculinity the way that I think we get, certainly by the time we get to Die Hard. But, but at the same time, there are these weird little moments of reversal where that space opens up just a little bit. Because, like, even with Anthor, the madam, well, for all the power she holds, she ends up getting shot 6 times in the back by Sylvester Stallone. But
yeah. Well, and that's the thing. I mean, it's interesting. Again, I mean, if we sort of take that meta-commentary on this being sort of, you know, in part a critical ode to an era that's, you know, passed by or is at least fading and dying away, I mean, it's not... It's very notable that almost all of these elements we're talking about are associated with the younger generation, the up-and-comers. Like, I mean, Charlotte Rampling was, you know, becoming a major star of this period. There's no overlooking the fact she is significantly younger than Robert Mitchum is in this movie. And likewise, basically all the power players aside from Mitchum pretty much are. I'm trying to think if there's anybody other than the judge who would technically count as older. And... No, not really.
What about John Ireland? But, I mean, he's not exactly the romantic lead here.
And it's also notable that, yeah, I mean, his partner is Harry Dean Stanton as the more crooked partner who we literally see stealing stuff throughout this movie.
Yeah, Billy Rolfe. It's, I mean, Harry Dean Stanton, this movie is proof that he suffers from Gene Hackman syndrome, where all of his life he's looked at least 48 years old.
very true. But yeah, I mean, it's kind of interesting if I don't want to, you know, push it too much and say that, you know, this is a film that's a commentary on, you know, the death of old classic Hollywood, because I think that's overstating the case a bit much. But it's hard not to see an element of that in the way in which things are working. In the way in which it's playing. I mean, certainly this isn't Last Tango in Paris with the combination of our sort of Truffaut, Brando, and who was the other male star in that?
I'm going to level with you, Dave. Part of why I flunked out of a film PhD program, it might be because I've never actually gotten around to watching Last Tango in Paris. I have a copy.
You're not missing anything.
It's so hard to set aside the time, you know? And yeah, I said it, and I feel better for having said it. But yeah, like, I mean, there are films that even come out of this decade that have a similar project and are more incisively critical, that are more fully engaged with sort of a not historical revisionism, but a historical reframing of period, or bringing the subaltern to the fore. This film does it in small gestures, because I think you're right, this film isn't concerned with doing that as a project, but the way that it does it, even in a minimal sense, just makes it a very, it comes off as a film that would have fit in very well with its period, yet it could not have happened during its period.
Yeah, no, very much so. I mean, it really does walk that fine line of carefully updating something that's very classical in its structure and its tropes and what it's doing. And again, credit to where credit's due also, we haven't really mentioned the screenwriter David Zalig Goodman, who's probably most notorious for writing Straw Dogs and Logan's Run a year later, from after this film. But his script is pretty tightly constructed. And again, you know, even if you're just paying attention to this from a dialogue standpoint, it's snappy as can be and immensely quotable.
It is so good. And a lot of it is influenced by Chandler, who, you know, there's a reason people still read him today. He had a knack for great dialogue. But especially delivered by Robert Mitchum, it's perfect.
Yeah.
And like, for instance, when they're asking about why he even agreed to help Malloy in the first place, he says, I can't help it. Ever since I saw King Kong, I've had a soft spot for big gorillas that fall in love with a pretty lady.
It's such a great line.
Or when he talks about his integrity as an investigator, how Rolf turns to him and says, "You're not a detective, you're a slot machine. You'll do anything for 3 bits." Yeah. Like, yeah, it's just like there's a snappiness to it. And I mean, like, yeah, and I think also owing to the script and even owing to, like, the classic Hollywood style, this film is 90, 95 minutes or so. It is a brisk film because it has that classical studio pacing where there's zero downtime. None of the scenes are dead. Everything that happens before the camera happens to move the plot forward. And once the plot is finally resolved, we have the tiny little coda scene, and that's it. Like, it's such a breezy film to watch, and it's so entertaining all the way through. Like, it's all killer and no filler.
Well, no, absolutely, and I think that's, again, one of the things. I mean, it's a film that, while there are, you know, I would say some pleasures to be found beneath the surface, those surface pleasures are really, really enjoyable in this thing. And I mean, this is kind of a perfect Saturday afternoon movie, in a way. Like, I could see this thing totally playing, you know, if it weren't for the occasional bits of graphic nudity and, you know, bloodshed, you know, playing Saturday afternoon as your sort of matinee film and just people, you know, sitting down on the couch and watching it. And on that level, this is perfectly great. I mean, there's something to be said for that here. And certainly, I mean, I don't want to oversell the movie. I mean, I think there's always that risk of saying, well, this is, you know, some lost masterpiece and classic that you absolutely have to see. And as much as I love it, I don't want to oversell it to the point where somebody's going to not enjoy its charms. But yeah, do yourselves a favor and check this film out.
Well, I think it's also just very indicative of the flexibility of noir. And especially being made in 1975 at sort of like this this intersection of major shifts in film style, in film production, in film as an industry in America. You know, it's certainly not the only one of its time. Like, I'm thinking Night Moves in particular would probably be a good companion piece, but the other ones skew much more heavy towards, like, the deconstruction and sort of the cahiers du cinéma approach towards it, whereas Farewell, My Lovely reminds us all, first and foremost, that the reason we like classic noir is that it's so enjoyable. It's fast. It's exciting. It's quotable. It doesn't have to be the most deep or profoundly socially impactful film that there is. And it's not trying to be. It's enjoyable in its own right. And I know that may sound weird coming from the guy who always yells about politics, but Yeah, you know, it's I will say that I didn't even know this film existed until you brought it to my attention. And I will say that of all the films we've looked at so far, this has been probably the most pleasant surprise. And it almost is enough to make me forgive you for Where the Buffalo Roam.
You think that that's the one that I'm going to need to be forgiven for? You
Oh,
have
I know
no
you're
idea what's
going to
coming.
top it, Damon. I know you are going to top it. And, well, it just means I have to put a couple duds in my back pocket to get you back.
That's fair. But before we get there, I guess probably since I think we're sort of wrapping this up here, we should probably hit to our picks in
Hits and
our hits
picks.
and pits.
Patent
One of
pending.
these days I'll remember. So yeah, Andrew, you know what? I've kicked off these, I think, every episode we've done so far. So I'm gonna, flip the order here. I'm gonna toss it to you first. What is your first hit with this one?
I think in terms of just like a small isolable moment, I really like the final shots of this film because I think it very efficiently wraps it up while at the same time summarizing Marlowe as a character pretty perfectly while maintaining that whole the idea of as we talked about with the World War II backdrop. Like, this is not a film where everything is figured out, or where Marlowe completely redeems himself or turns anybody's life around. People end up dead, you know, he ends up getting paid for his job, and then he goes home and realizes, what's that line where he says, I realized I had a couple thousand in my pocket that was burning a hole, and I knew somebody who could use it more. And he just walks to the now deceased trumpet player's apartment, and like, I like it because there's no great big kiss. There's no ride off into the sunset. It's just, hey, Marlowe's still alive. He solved this one, and he's going to make the next right decision. And I think that's nice. I think it works with the character very well, and it works with this film very well. It's very efficient and economical. What about you, Dave?
I'm going to give credit to, again, in the spirit of small moments, the bit between Robert Mitchum and Sylvia Miles, Jessie, when he first hands her the bottle of liquor, sort of the bribe to get her talking. She wanders into the kitchen to get them both a glass, and there's a bit of business where Mitchum's just peeking into the kitchen as she gets it, and you see her getting a glass and a not so clean glass that she sort of wants to disguise, and the way in which both actors play their reactions and behavior in that scene is just delightful.
Well, also when she goes into the kitchen, she looks over her shoulder and takes herself a hearty knock out of the bottle.
Exactly. Yes. It is just, I mean, it's a bit of, funny character business that works, and again, watching Mitchum play the rest of it once he sort of has a real full understanding as to what he's dealing with is just kind of a hoot, for the rest of it there. But so yeah, so that's just a small moment. But what about you, Andrew? Another hit by any chance?
I think we'd be remiss if we didn't talk a little more about Jack Halloran, because Moose Malloy is the perfect character for him to play. This guy's like a legit 6'8", I think. He also claims to be the son of Albert Anastasia, the famous underworld gangster. I think he was out of New York. As far as I know, that was never proven, but man, oh man, like he conveys everything that the character needs to, where he's soft-spoken and seems like just sort of slow-witted, but the moment that things get real, like there are scenes of him like just shoving people out of doorways. And I love the part where the phone rings, and in the middle of a conversation, he thinks that it might be Vera on the other end of the line. So he just storms through and just moves, like physically lifts people out of his way. And like he's an interesting character because, yeah, there's that simplicity to him, but there's always that omnipresent threat of menace. And it's very easy to forget that, yeah, we're introduced to this guy by him announcing that he just did 7 years for armed robbery and then he kills somebody. And I mean the whole as Marlowe says after his untimely death, he ends up being shot in the back by Vera, but Marlowe notices that it doesn't matter to him that Vera lied to him, that she turned him in. It doesn't even matter to him that, you know, she ended up killing him because he loves her, and that's always going to be good enough. I'm like, oh, it's sad. It's so bittersweet. It is the King Kong story.
It is, but what makes it even better is, and I, you know, I'll count this as my second hit here just to say, is there is something of a way which, again, it comes out of Chandler's novel, and it's also featured in the other one, but it places even funnier here is the fact that Moose Malloy, the fact that they can't, nobody can find him, is like a great running gag.
Mm-hmm.
Because, yeah, he is this sick, again, like a 6 foot tall individual who, again, by all indication, not necessarily the brightest individual, blunders into situations. And the way in which he leaves scenes, such as an attempted gangland hit, more or less, where him and Marlo are ambushed, and they both walk away. Literally, he just walks off, and nobody gets him. And it's one of those gags that, logically, this should not work, but my God, is it funny that it does. Watching it throughout the film. So, I mean, a small gag, a small pleasure, but one I am very, very much enjoying myself here. But yeah, so I guess that brings us to, we've gone through the hits. What about a pit, Andrew? What do you have going for us on this one?
Honestly, like, this is kind of hard to think of, because, like, I almost, even if I could find criticisms of this film, it almost feels unfair. Like, I have no problem critiquing Terrence Malick or Christopher Nolan or films that aim to be so grandiose that when they fail, it's so infuriating. Like, this is a film that plays it sort of closer to the middle, where I feel like it's not trying to make capital A art. It just, it knows what it needs to do, and it largely succeeds. I think, like, even the idea of some of the racially problematic language and things like that, like, no. I don't feel it's egregious enough that it rises to the level of, say, Jackie Brown or something like that. Or it doesn't come off as frivolous in the sense that, like, later neo-noir might. And certainly James Ellroy's novels certainly do.
Yeah,
it's just, I don't know, maybe it's just, yeah, I honestly, I'm trying to think here. I mean, they were smart enough not to give Stallone any dialogue. I mean, it's more that, like, I realize the use of Technicolor and sort of the framing and that, and the aestheticization of the classic noir, it's used to really interesting effect, but I am deeply curious what would happen if they just tried to make it a little prettier. But then I'm like, no, then it would be a fundamentally different film. So, honestly, Dave, like, it's not boring. Everybody plays their parts well that I can think of. It's snappy. It's fun. It resolves neatly. It doesn't even have, like, the who killed Owen Taylor mystery that The Big Sleep has.
Yeah.
I don't know if I can find something to criticize.
I would say probably, if I could, if there's something to criticize, and it's not a major criticism, but to build off of your idea of being a little prettier, I think at points Dick Richards' direction is a tad bit of point-and-shoot at points, but so much of it is, you know, well-considered and well-executed that it's hard to hold those minuscule moments against him.
And even then, the film has a built-in defense where it's like, well, we're trying to throw back to the studio style. It's not like Michael Curtiz was hiring helicopters to do, like, dazzling spiral down shots or anything like that. I mean, in the studio era, it was directors for hire pointing and shooting, right?
It is. I would say there are sequences such as when they get to Jesse's house and that, where you really get the sense in the way in which it's framed that if they probably opened that frame up, like, you know, just a little bit more, you'd see, like, some big modern building right beside it. Like, there are points where you get the feeling that this is, it's tightly in because this is very much a, we don't want to, we're definitely don't have the budget to hide anything else through any other means necessary. And again, I don't fault, again, I don't want to come down on Richards too hard because of that. Because, again, you know, if you're working on a tight budget, I don't blame you for doing something like that, necessarily. I mean, you do what you can in the way that you need to get it done to tell your story and be still as interesting as possible.
That's exactly what Philip Marlowe did, so.
Yeah, so, Dick Richards living by the mottos of his movies. So I guess so.
So yeah, anything else you'd like to throw in, Dave?
I think we've covered this film about as well as we can. I mean, yeah, it's a, you know, I highly recommend picking it up. It's definitely, if you come across the Blu-ray, it's worth, you know, the money to spend on this. I can't speak for its sister film, The Big Sleep 78, yet. I've heard it's terrible. Probably is, but I will go in with an open mind.
All right. Well, yeah, it's, I mean, that's one of the dilemmas where whenever we have a film that we both enjoy, it's like, well, either there has to be a lot of subtext that we can dive deep into and argue about, or it's 90 minutes of us just going, hey, and then I liked this part. But honestly, yeah, I really enjoyed this film. I think anybody that is a fan of procedurals, of noir style, of New Hollywood, you're right. It's a great Saturday afternoon movie. But that means we are going to be leaving sunny California, and we're going to be taking our trip elsewhere.
So where are we going, Andrew? I see you control the wheel and I have a gun at my head at the moment.
Ah, yes. well, you know, I took a couple cues out of the Mitchum playbook. I think we are going to be taking the road down south once again, courtesy of our friend Charlotte Rampling. And it's about a 12-year drive that'll take us to 1987's neo-noir, Alan Parker's Angel Heart, which I am so excited to talk about with you, because I think it'll be interesting to see what another 12 years does to the idea of neo-noir, especially when you're transplanting it out of familiar locations and into Louisiana.
Is it okay if I tip my hand a little bit on this one?
I think you can.
I'm just going to say this. This is one of the few films I will say scared the living hell out of me. And I will say no more.
I've never been able to eat eggs ever since. Or watch The Cosby Show, but that's for two reasons.
Boo. So anyway, so yeah, so we're definitely going to get to that one next. Until then, you can find me on Twitter at 24panels, which is my handle. Andrew, again, you now have an official show channel and you're home on Twitter now. And can you remind people where to find me?
Yes, you can shout out to me at Filmstripper. And yeah, it's good to be back. Currently, I'm very active in making jokes about Leslie Nielsen dialogue with you, and snarkily tweeting at right-wing media figures. So direct all your letters to Dave. So yeah, otherwise, if you like what you're hearing, the best way to help us grow an audience is to share on Facebook, leave any star review on iTunes or whatever podcatcher you're using. And honestly, you know, we're still figuring it out as we go, if you couldn't already tell. But the easiest way for us to make this into something you want to listen to is to let us know. Trust us, we're 30-year-olds that have gone to art school, but, you know, we're not as sensitive as we might look.
Yes, exactly. And don't forget also, folks, that all the music you hear on this program is by one Andrew Kanagiser. Again, if you look on SoundCloud, you can find some of his other recordings as well to give it a listen to.
Yes. Friend of the show, Andrew Kanagiser. Check it out. We're slowly building ourselves a media empire, which is all right because somebody's got to stand up to Sinclair. And now I sound like my Twitter account again. So shall we wrap it up for this week, Dave?
Yes, so until next time, I'm Dave Babbitt.
And I'm Andrew Kanagiser. And remember, adventure might scare you, but monotony will kill you.
Bye, folks.